Session number 8634, General Alan Younger, Reel 1.
General Younger, Reel 1. How did you first become involved with the preparations for D-Day?
I commanded 2-6 Assault Squadron, Royal Engineers, which as a major, which was one of 4 assault squadrons in 5 Assault Regiment, Royal Engineers, which was one of 3 regiments in 1st Assault Brigade, Royal Engineers, one of the brigades in 79 Armoured Division.
Which Armoured Division?
79, commanded by the redoubtable Sir Percy Hubbard.
And what was the role of 2-6 Assault Squadron?
Our role, as with all the other Assault Squadron roles, was to land in front of other troops on the beaches in order to clear away obstacles and enable particularly tanks following behind to keep up with the infantry and go on inland and take the proper bridgehead.
What equipment would you have?
We had, in each squadron, we had 4 troops. Each troop contained 6 AVRY, Assault Vehicles, Royal Engineers. And on those AVRYs were various sort of improvisations for getting over or through whatever obstacles we expected to meet. And we had a pretty fair idea of what we would meet from air photographs taken of the beaches we were going to land on. These improvisations included a thing called a fascine, which was a huge bundle of chestnut paling about 10 or 12 feet across, which was held on a little ramp on the front of the tank, could be released and could fill up a ditch. It included an assault bridge which could be dropped and then the tank could go on up it, and so on.
Can you describe one of these AVRY vehicles?
Yes, it was a Churchill tank. I suppose weighed about 40 tons. We had a crew of 6 in the tank, driver and gunner sitting down in the front of the tank, and then a wireless operator and a commander, perhaps it was 5, and I think one other man in the turret. It didn't have the ordinary gun, which I suppose in those days was a 75 millimeter or something. We had a thing called the petard, which was a code name for a spigot mortar, which fired a charge of about 25 pounds of explosive, a limited distance, I think about 50 yards was the maximum range. The object of this was to break up concrete, so that if you met a wall, for instance, and you couldn't get over it in any other way, you could smash it down. And I think each tank had 26, if my memory is right, of these charges inside that could be fired. We also had a lot of shaped charges called General Wades. I think we had another 26 of them, and these were they each weighed about, I suppose, 25, 30 pounds. And they were shaped charges that could be placed, again, on concrete to smash it up. But you had to get out, of course, of the tank to do this. Get out, clamp them onto, we had special clamping bars and things, clamp it onto the concrete, get back in, pull a string, and then there'd be a terrific bang, and hopefully all the concrete would fall to pieces, and you'd climb up it.
What do you mean by a shaped charge?
A shaped charge is a technical term. You get a greater effect from explosive by shaping it. Instead of having a block of explosive, if you for instance, make a conical hole in the explosive, you get a jet coming away when you detonate the explosive, which is more localized and more powerful in the localized area than if you just had a flat piece of explosive. And these were shaped rather like a bridge. There's a in Scotland there are things called General Wade bridges, which are low humpback bridges. And so this thing was a sort of curved charge, and through the middle ran a channel, a curved channel, so that it was directional in effect. You put the flat end onto the concrete and blew it off from the top, and so the main force was directed onto the concrete.
So it was to direct the main force downwards?
Correct, yes.
How did you find the working of the Avery vehicles? Were they satisfactory?
Yes. we'd had some pretty clapped-out ones for training, but when the training finished, we got new ones in preparation for D-Day, which we, of course, had to waterproof and load up and so on, and they worked right, yeah. It was a slow old thing, but it was pretty reliable.
What would the strength of the squadron have been?
I honestly don't remember, but I should think about 300.
And what kind of men were there? Regulars or?
Oh no, very few regulars. Senior NCOs were regulars. Otherwise, they were National Service. But they by then, of course, had been. Most of them had been in the army for, you know, 2-3 years. So they were fairly experienced by then. But only most of them on training. Very few had, in fact, been to Dunkirk, and practically none to North Africa.
What was their quality?
Oh, very good. Very good men. I don't think I can say anything more than that. I took over the squadron, I think, in October of 43, and we did a lot of training, very hard training, and I would say that the spirit in the squadron was excellent. Some of the troop commanders were better than others, of course, which is always the case, but the quality was high.
When you were given the assignment to take over the squadron in October 1943, were you told the purpose for which you were preparing?
Yes, I think I knew that, because I worked for, I suppose, about a month in brigade headquarters. Brigade was commanded by a very fine officer, a very imaginative officer called Brigadier Watkinson, Ginger Watkinson. He's dead now. And I worked for him in the brigade for, I think, about a month. And, of course, we knew that the whole object was to, well, it was what I said, to clear away obstacles in front of infantry and armour that would follow us. We didn't at that stage know when D-Day would be, nor where. We didn't get that information until, I would think, something about April. But of course, I think by then we knew, or sometime during the winter, we knew that there would be three divisions doing this assault. 3rd British Div, 50 Div, and 3rd Canadian Division. And sometime towards the spring, I suppose, we were definitely allocated to the Canadians to lead one of the Canadian brigades ashore.
What was the nature of the preparation which you undertook in the months leading up to D-Day?
We were all very new to driving tanks around. We got a draft of drivers from the Royal Armoured Corps who had driven tanks before, and so this got us off to a good start. And they were good lads too. But to start with, we had to practice the launching of these obstacles, the command of tanks, use of wireless, keeping together, and so on. Then we started to do assault landings, both to get to know the naval people who would take us, and also to do some practice in that type of warfare, which none of us had ever done before. And we did the first of these in the winter in Scotland. We were based on Fort George, Inverness, and we did, I think, two quite sort of major assaults on beaches along the coast there, and the Navy took us somewhere out into the North Sea in midwinter, which wasn't a particularly attractive experience, and then back towards the coast. They did this during the night, back towards the coast. We landed about dawn on some isolated beach, sort of area of Elgin. Most of these were pretty catastrophic exercises. All sorts of things went wrong, but we were learning. And we learned how to waterproof our vehicles better and so on. And gradually we learned. Then we moved back down to the south, and I think we came under the Canadian Division then for the first time, did some exercises on Studland Beach, and I think one near Chichester, probably one of the Wittering Beaches or something like that. And we did some training against a wall on the Isle of Wight, which we were told to go and use our petards on, because we hadn't fired. These were fearsome weapons, and we'd never fired them in earnest. And so we went one day and bashed down a length of wall on the north coast of the Isle of Wight, somewhere near Osborne House, which was quite a good exercise to train the men.
Osborne House?
Osborne House, which is on the north coast of the Isle of Wight.
What type of things went wrong in these exercises in Scotland?
Vehicles broke down. Coming off a landing craft when the sea is rough isn't particularly easy. And sometimes we get a vehicle, an Avery, broken down in the actual entrance of the landing craft, LCT. And had to be towed off and so on. Oh, everything went wrong. And then we would launch our bridges against something or other, and the bridge would slip. And we had, I remember one tank climbing up one of the bridges, fell off it, and turned upside down. And I think a couple of chaps got quite badly hurt doing that. Everything that you can think of went wrong. But we were learning all the time and getting better. And by the time D-Day came round, we were really quite good.
What were the main difficulties that you had in learning to adapt to tanks?
I think purely that it was an entirely different thing to our previous experience. I mean, as sappers, as you know, I've been out in Dunkirk. I've been used to blowing up bridges, moving by ordinary vehicles, we were trained in building bridges, laying minefields, lifting minefields, all that sort of thing. And here was something completely different, which we just hadn't trained in before. And, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, if you're suddenly put inside a tank, you can't just drive it off, and you can't even drive off a motor car without a bit of training. And we certainly needed some training in this. And, of course, we'd never used wireless to the same extent as you have to in a tank. I mean, you can't talk to any of your subordinate tanks without wireless, and we'd never used that. And we were very verbose and long-winded initially in our use of the wireless. And as you get more confident in it, you get far quicker, and you just and people recognise your voice, and you cut everything down, so that in the end the conversations are just click, 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 and you know exactly what the man meant. And it takes very little time on the air, because the trouble with being verbose on the air is that someone else has got something much more important to say, and he can't get on the air because the air is blocked by you making a sort of long-winded statement.
You said that you got to know the details of the landing as early as April. Was much security stressed?
Oh, yes. I was the only person in the squadron who knew, and I wasn't permitted to tell anybody. And it wasn't until sometime in May that I gave my orders to the squadron. I mean, they were still, so to speak, betting amongst themselves as to whether we'd be landing in Denmark or Calais or where. They hadn't the slightest idea where it was, where it would be. The security was absolutely 100%.
Did the place of landing come as a surprise to you?
I don't think so particularly. I was told that it was at more or less the limit of range of our escorting fighter aircraft. And I think I felt, well, it's probably a good thing to be landing there rather than the part of Calais, where I'm sure the defences are much much stronger, and therefore we'd have a worse time on the landing. I can't say it was a surprise.
What about the date of the landing? Did that surprise you?
No. I just knew that we had to land when the tide was right, i.e. we would land early in the morning when the tide was fairly low but rising, because you can't land on a falling tide, otherwise all your landing craft may get stranded on the beach. So you have to land on a rising tide so they can drop off their load and still back off and get away. And there were just a few days every month when the tides would be right. I don't think it was ever said when D-Day would be. This is why it was called D-Day. On D-Day, the landings would take place, and we never really knew until finally, when we were on landing craft, waiting in Southampton Water, and it was very windy, and it was postponed. And then finally, the word came through, OK, we're off. It was always referred to as D-Day, and our time of landing was HR. And we didn't even know when HR would be. We just knew it would be in the morning. It wasn't until, I think, this final thing when they said, I think HR would be 7:30 in the morning.
Had you been impatient to get on with the landing in Europe, or had people accepted it?
I don't think we thought about it too much. We were training hard to acquire the skills which we realised we must have in order to make a successful landing. This is quite complex, these bits of equipment we had. And as I say, we made mistake after mistake, and we just had to go on at it until we were trained. And luckily for us, we just about trained by the time the 6th of June 44 came round. But we were by no means perfect even then. I mean, we could have done with a bit more training, but we were sufficiently well equipped to know we wouldn't make a nonsense of it.
With what kind of mood did you approach D-Day? Was it with apprehension or not?
Well, strangely enough, it wasn't. I think we'd done so many training exercises by then that it was difficult almost to realise that this was the real thing. It was just a case of, we've done all this before, come on, let's get it done, we've got better tanks this time, let's get it done and go ahead with it. I think on future occasions when I had to sort of do assaults, such as across the Rhine, I got far more worked up than on this one. It was just another training exercise, but the supporting gunfire was for real instead of just being blanks.
Did you not feel that it was an historic occasion?
I don't think I thought about that. No. I knew I had a job to do, and I was far more interested in making sure that nothing could go wrong with that job than with worrying about whether it was a historic occasion or not, quite honestly.
Do you think your brother officers and the men felt the same?
I should think so. I should think so, yes.
Now, can you give me the chronology in detail of what happened to you from the moment of setting off?
Yes, certainly. Well, we loaded our tanks somewhere in Southampton Water with all these fascines and bridges and whatnot on them. We had under command... Now, first let me explain that my squadron was really split into two halves because we were due to land on Mike Beach. Mike Beach at Courcelles. And at Courcelles is a river. The Searle. So half the squadron, that's one and two troops, would land to the right of the river, to the west of the river, and the other half, and that incidentally is opposite the village of Grez-sur-Mer, the other half of the squadron, the other two troops, would land on Nan Beach, which is to the east of the river, and opposite the town of Courcelles itself, the river splitting us completely. Therefore, as I say, we really had two half squadrons. Now, I was in charge of the right-hand half squadron, and I put the senior troop commander, who was a chap called Dickie Bowes, who was killed later, in charge of the left-hand half squadron. Now, where did I got to? Well, we loaded up into, I should think, four landing craft for each half squadron, a total of eight landing craft. Now we had on under command two troops, I think, of flails, flail tanks, which came from 22nd Dragoons, from another brigade in 79 Armoured Div. And each of our landing craft had a couple of flail tanks on there with them. So we loaded up. We sat around just moored in Southampton Water for, I would think, about three nights. It was very windy, but we just, I think then we knew, of course, so the orders had been given out. Still, nobody except myself knew where we were going, and I had the maps, a huge great roll of maps for my landing craft, and the senior officer on each boat had another roll of maps. But we were not permitted to open those maps. We had been operating, doing all our planning, on a map which was identical to, it showed identical features of the coast, i.e. rivers and villages and hills and so on, but all the names had been rubbed out, and names like Washington and London and so on had been put in instead. So still, the members of my squadron didn't know where they were going. Then on, I suppose, about the third day, early in the morning, I think about perhaps in the morning, we got orders to move, and we went down Southampton Water, round the Isle of Wight and out into the Solent, and it was very rough. I gave orders for the maps to be opened. We were told whatever the code was came through, that should be done, and I had a second lieutenant on board my boat called David Pratt, and I told him to unroll this enormous great bag of maps and divide them into lots, one for each tank. And then I went up and stood on the bridge with the skipper. Gradually we pulled out to sea. I remember that we were the front craft. In front of us there was a naval frigate, Royal Navy frigate, and behind us, as far as the eye could see, were other landing craft, two lines of landing craft. It seemed to get rougher and rougher, the boat being tossed all over the place. I went, after I'd been up there, I thought I'd go and lie down for a bit. And by then it was afternoon, I went down, I found that poor David Pratt was suffering badly from seasickness, and the maps were all over the little cabin there. And he was absolutely out, lying on top of them all, having been badly seasick. So I sorted out the maps and sort of pushed him onto a bunk. And then lay down for a bit myself. Then I was seasick. And I suppose, I don't know, we had a meal of some sort, probably, although I don't think any of us were particularly interested in food. And then I had a bit of a sleep. And I suppose someone was told to wake us up, although I don't think I needed any waking. And I got up and shaved. And there was the beach in view, in the distance, in front of us.
Were there any aircraft overhead?
Yep. Yes, there was a continual chain of aircraft. And, of course, there were some big ships there. Battleships firing great salvos at the beach. And also there was, as we came closer to the beach, a landing craft with, I don't know how many, hundreds and hundreds of rockets drew in front of us and went across the beach, firing off waves and waves and waves of these rockets, and then pulled away, leaving the beach clear for us to land.
Did it look like what you expected?
Absolutely. I knew exactly where I was. The photographs we'd been working on were excellent. By then, our landing craft had developed some engine trouble, and instead of leading, I was, in fact, rather behind, and I saw our first landing craft landing. But I knew exactly where I ought to be, where I was, yes, and where I planned to land.
Were you under enemy fire at this time?
There were a few puffs of something bursting in the water. But, of course, when you're in a tank, we had, of course, radio silence. We weren't allowed to open up our radios until we landed. But we were just sitting there. I had my tin hat on. And you can't see much when you're in the tank, in a landing craft. But it was obvious that there was some, yes, there was some enemy fire, but nothing to worry us that much. It wasn't until we started to land that we really ran into it.